Welcome to today's program titled Employee Social Networking, Protecting Your Trade Secrets in Social Media. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you're encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left-hand corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or a legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form sent with the login information email. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of this webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn it over to John Tomaszewski, Eric Barton, Joshua Salinas. You may now begin.
Thank you so much. I want to thank everybody for attending today's webinar. We have an exciting topic on the interplay between social media and trade secrets with this kind of a unique and developing area, particularly because you have this somewhat of an inherent conflict between trade secrets and social media. As we'll discuss more further in depth today with trade secrets, you have this confidential information that gets its value because it is secret, because it is confidential, and that trade secret holder has to take some reasonable efforts to keep it secret. Social media, on the other hand, is kind of based on this kind of fundamental notion of sharing everything, of letting everybody know what you're doing, who you are, where you are. And so when you have this interplay of something that you're trying to keep secret, but also a new technology that is about sharing and disclosing, you do get some new unique challenges. And as in some of the cases we'll discuss today, some of the courts have recognized that technology is just moving way too fast, and the courts and the legal system are somewhat behind in catching up to speed. So we have a great list of presenters today. First, we have John Tomaszewski. He's a senior counsel in our Houston office. He's also in the privacy and data security group. John has significant experience counseling companies in data privacy, data protection, information security in Americas, in Europe, and also in Asia. He's also an author on our firm's Global Privacy Watch blog, if you wanted to stay up to date on some of the new privacy and security law issues. We also have Eric Barton. He's a counsel in our Atlanta office. He's also in the Trade Secrets, Computer Fraud, and Non-Competes group. And Eric also has significant experience advising clients and drafting agreements regarding the protection of confidential information and protecting client relationships. He's also an author on our firm's Trade Secrets Law blog. My name is Joshua Salinas. I'm an attorney here in Los Angeles. I'm also on the Trade Secrets Computer Fraud and Non-Competes group, and also an author on our firm's Trade Secret blog. So to give a kind of general overview of what we're going to be discussing today, we do have some really great and interesting topics. We're going to first cover the kind of social media privacy legislation. Every state has either enacted some type of social media legislation or made some type of research or report or study, and really they're looking into how they can protect people's private social media accounts and private social media information. Unfortunately, there's no kind of uniform or nationwide legislation regarding the protection of social media accounts, particularly here in the context of either employees or students. And each state has enacted their own type of legislation, which we'll discuss. And we'll kind of go into what are the differences and remedies that are available under each one. We'll next talk about the laws impacting employers' trade secrets and proprietary assets, and we'll see kind of the new cases, new developments, and seeing whether companies can actually protect information that's online. What are the kind of unique challenges? Just kind of as a disclaimer, because this area of law is still developing and somewhat unsettled, a lot of these cases are going to be either highly fact dependent or could vary based on your jurisdiction. We'll then go into some of the employee social media policies as companies want to protect their information and control or restrict the activities that their employees can do online using social media accounts. There are some concerns where you don't want to invoke the ire of the National Labor Relations Board, who has been somewhat active in this area, scrutinizing policies that they think are either overly broad or activities that are being taken against employees based on different social media policies. And then finally, we'll go over some recent privacy and security law developments in this area. I know there was a recent case, we won't discuss it, but we've seen, at least with I think the IRS, had a recent incident of being purportedly hacked and having some consumer information purportedly accessed. So to go into kind of social media, you know, why actually do we care about this? I think most of us are familiar with social media and now are aware that it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. Facebook, you know, has over a billion monthly active users. Probably more interesting about this fact is about half of those are on a mobile device. And so many companies know that, you know, employees are going to try to access Facebook. Some companies have taken the security measures of actually blocking access to Facebook or other social media sites on the internal computer networks. But there are, you know, a lot of employees who do have, you know, smartphones now with high-speed internet access with cameras. And so, you know, sometimes it's somewhat difficult to prevent, you know, somebody, an employee, from completely accessing any social media whatsoever. LinkedIn, we're seeing about 2 new members are joining LinkedIn every second. LinkedIn is, we've seen, probably become more popular with you know, sales representatives, companies who are trying to stay, you know, interactive or build those client relationships, and so they're connecting through LinkedIn. Google Plus has over about 100 million or 300 million monthly active users. YouTube, which is surprising, has over 4 billion video views each day alone. And then Twitter, about 58 million tweets daily. So we're just seeing not only just the exponential rise and the surprising amount of data that's being collected, data that's being generated, the connections that are being made between different users, between companies using these accounts. So in kind of the business atmosphere, you know, why do we really care about social media? You know, more and more companies have gone on board and realizing, you know, how valuable a resource and tool social media can be, with, you know, connecting with customers, with clients, with, you know, advertising products, marketing, or collecting data to see how consumers are perceiving or viewing products. You know, it's really risen in the past couple of years, just exponentially, of more and more people, more and more businesses getting on board. There's a recent worldwide survey done. I think it was in Forbes, I was reporting on it. About 75% of the respondents reported that they'd use social media for business purposes. But one of the issues was about two-thirds of the businesses actually monitor their employees' use of social media. And so what's sometimes the case is so many companies want to get into social media, want to get in line, want to rush to get out there to get their accounts created. But once that's created, once that's generated, once employees are put in charge of that, sometimes there's a loss of oversight or monitoring. And so disputes can arise regarding, you know, well, who actually does own that account, who owns that information on the account, if any of those contacts or information can actually be owned. And then what happens when the employee leaves the company, you know, who does that account belong to? So we've seen social media become, you know, really prevalent in the workplace, but employees now have even more access to their personal social media accounts in the workplace, and just that proximity of having, you know, business accounts, personal accounts. There has been some concern, which really driven some of the recent legislation. Within the last couple of years, more and more states have gone on board to enact some type of social media legislation to protect either employees from employers trying to access or demand access to private social media accounts, and also with students who are applying to different schools and colleges. and those schools demanding access to their credentials to see their profiles. So we've seen about almost every state, if they haven't enacted legislation yet, has addressed it, discussed it, or implemented some type of study to further review it. There's about a total of 21 states to date that have implemented some type of social media legislation for employees. Delaware is not listed. I believe they only have some social media legislation to protect students, but not employees yet. There's two states that are not listed here regarding employers, and that's, I think it's Montana and Connecticut, who just in the last couple weeks implemented their own social media legislation for protecting private personal social media accounts. Unfortunately, there's no kind of uniform nationwide legislation. Each state has adopted implemented their own type of legislation with its own language, scope, remedies available. And so there is some, you know, challenges, especially if employers have employees in multiple states, multiple jurisdictions, of trying to comply with these different requirements. What we've actually done is prepared a survey, which we started generating, creating, and tracking these different states' legislations once they started coming out. And so we have a survey of the different states' legislation, what is the language, kind of the issues, potential concerns. Because there has been some recent states in the last couple weeks who have been implementing their own new legislation, we are currently revising our survey. So we hope to get that out soon with the new states that are on board. And then we can definitely circulate to anybody who does want access once it's ready for once it's final. So while different states do have different different legislation implemented for social media, they all generally have the same concept and somewhat same approach of they're really trying to protect personal social media account access. So generally, most states have legislation that says the employer cannot demand or acquire the username or password to an employee's personal social media account. The employer cannot demand that the employee add the company or a representative onto the account as, you know, like a joint holder or like have a, you know, administrator access. And then also many states prevent shoulder surfing, which is kind of indirect access where the employer demands that the employee log into the account while the employer is kind of looking over their shoulder or trying to see information that way. Many states have protections against retaliation for invoking these statutory rights. So if an employee or applicant does refuse to provide access to their personal social media account, the employer is not allowed to retaliate or take any adverse action for that. The consequences vary from state to state on what happens if there is a violation of these statutes. You have some states, for example, like Oregon, who have taken more of a heavy-handed, aggressive approach and allow availability of bringing a lawsuit, penalties, damages, attorney's fees, back pay, reinstatement. Some other states, on the other hand, have taken more of a lighter approach. New Jersey, for example, the employee can make a complaint to the Department of Labor. They may investigate and impose nominal penalties, but it's definitely not as it doesn't have as much teeth as some states like Oregon. So actually, what is permitted under this social media legislation? The employer can get access to non-personal and or employer accounts, as we'll see in some of the cases we discussed today, and which has kind of been an issue is, you know, what is the line between the employer's account and the employee's personal account? Generally, when the employer asks the employee to create the account, it's used for business purposes. Sometimes you may have an agreement that that account belongs to the employer. There's definitely more evidence and there'd be a likelihood that that account belongs to the employer, but there are issues if data is commingled or the employee comes in with a personal account and then uses that for business purposes. So, but the employer is able to get mandatory access to the business social media accounts or non-personal accounts. There is also the methods for conducting workplace investigations if there's any employment misconduct. If the employee is believed to have taken trade secrets or data, there is the availability for the employer to, get access to that information. Also, if there's any harassments being done by the coworker on social media against other coworkers. the employer can conduct some reasonable device and systems monitoring. There has been case law which has recognized that when the employer provides some reasonable notice, that they can, you know, monitor and track work devices, work equipment, work accounts. Again, there is also a concern is, you know, if any of those accounts are going to be going into any personal information, if there's any data commingled with personal personal information, which is always sometimes raised by the employee. There is availability for self-regulatory applicant screening, compliance with state and federal laws, and then the employers actually can use and search for any publicly available social media account information. So it doesn't completely mean that any social media account held by the employee is completely off limits. So there are actually some issues with this legislation. One of the problems is that because this legislation is relatively new, there's no published case law we've seen addressing these kind of employer-employee privacy disputes with regards to this specific legislation. Some states have actually defined what is personal a personal social media account. Some of them have not, and so there's still, you know, some ambiguous language and, you know, some vulnerability of, you know, when is an account personal and when does it actually belong to the employer. One issue we've started to see arise is when you have companies implementing BYOD policies, which is a bring your own device policy. The company will allow the employees to bring their own personal laptops, tablets, cell phones, and use that in the workplace, access the company's network and email. And there is some issues that can arise because now you have this kind of commingling of, you know, business accounts, business information, and, you know, the company tries to take security measures to protect its information, but there's also, you know, that employee's personal information that is rising on the same device. And, you know, sometimes the, you know, if the device is lost, the company will have a policy that, you know, those devices are remotely wiped and deleted, so nobody can find that information. But then the employee sometimes will object and try to say that, you know, well, they have personal private information on that device and they don't want it completely wiped at all. So with BYOD policies and this, you know, introduction of personal devices, it does create some new challenges for kind of distinguishing between, you know, the personal and employer accounted information. Another thing that is an issue of concern is, you know, what about the employer's trade secrets, their efforts to protect them, and, you know, what if there's litigation and there's discovery needed into those devices and accounts? And there's some measures to protect each entity's information, but there is definitely concern when employees are using their own personal accounts, personal devices to hide the company's, you know, trade secrets or take company information. Another issue is when you have, you know, these multi-states that have different types of social media legislation. What do you do when you have a company that has employees in multiple different states? So there is a, you know, an issue with conflict of laws. So kind of turning to the trade secret aspect, we've seen some recent legislation being implemented by within the last, you know, couple of years. The Obama administration has taken more of a focus onto kind of nations' security, cybersecurity, protection of trade secrets. There has been a recent enforcement efforts or prosecutions by the Department of Justice against, you know, people who have been trying to take trade secrets on behalf of foreign companies or foreign governments. In about 2013, the White House published this five-point plan to protect trade secrets. It was implemented around the same time. I think there had just been some allegations that the Chinese military was believed to have hacked the U.S. to obtain some confidential and high-value military weapon systems information. And so there has been more of an approach or a focus on trying to protect American trade secrets. The Obama administration implemented this five-point plan for protecting trade secrets and try to get legislation to protect American trade secrets. About, I think, a month or two after this plan was implemented, there was also a public call held or a public call for comment to try to get some input on what would be preferred or desired for some type of federal trade secret legislation. And so there's no current federal trade secret legislation currently in place right now, but it has been introduced and subject to some discussion. Also, there has been the Trade Secret Clarification Act was recently enacted a couple years ago. There was a dispute in the Alenikov case where a former employee who had allegedly taken some confidential source code, the conviction was ultimately reversed by the Second Circuit because there was some language in the Economic Espionage Act in which he was convicted under. It only applied to products or services that were in interstate commerce, and because the code that was taken was actually not directly or expressly in interstate commerce, it was being used to provide services intended to be used for interstate commerce. So the Economic Espionage Act was amended to provide some more expansive language to further prosecute crimes under the Economic Espionage Act. And also around that same time, there was an enhancement act that further increased the penalties and fines for EEA violations. So we've seen some of the recent legislation with both social media and trade secrets. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Eric Barton, who's going to further discuss kind of the interplay with trade secrets and social media and some of the recent developments and challenges.
Sorry about that. I was on mute. I apologize. My name is Eric Barton. I'm in SciFarth's Atlanta office. And for those of you hoping to hear a great Southern accent, unfortunately, I'm originally from the Midwest. So you don't get to hear Matlock. You get to hear my Midwestern voice. But with that said, let's talk a little bit about trade secrets in the context of social media. And before we delve into the details of trade secret cases in social media, I want to just take sort of a step back, and I'm sure most of you know this at this point, but trade secrets are essentially, those first four points are the definition of trade secrets, if you will. It's information generally not known to others, economically valuable, with reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy. And as we'll see as we get into the cases, really that point two and the point four, the generally not known and reasonable efforts to maintain secrecy are the ones that seem to come up over and over again in the context of whether or not something is a trade secret. Novelty not required, and there are some examples of what constitute trade secrets. And that, on that list, you'll see customer lists, client lists, customer lists often come up in social media cases involving trade secrets. Typically, trade secrets aren't just stamped trade secrets, and often there's a big fight as a result of whether information actually constitutes a trade secret or not. And on this slide here, you'll see six factors that courts often look at and weigh and consider in deciding whether or not something is a trade secret. Obviously, depending on your jurisdiction, depending on your court, the factors vary, the number of factors vary, the weight of the factors vary. But these are ones we typically see over and over again. And I'll highlight really point one on this list and point six on this list, the extent known outside the company and the ease of difficulty which it can be properly acquired or duplicated by others. Again, as we get into the cases in a second, those are going to be the ones that seem to come up over and over again. Either one side claims, look, everybody knew about this, you can't consider it a trade secret, or it's something that's so ubiquitous out there that it can be put together, easily acquired, and duplicated by others. Point three is that the measures taken by a company to protect secrecy, and that's an important factor in trade secret social media cases as well. Because, of course, a company needs to demonstrate, it's imperative that a company demonstrates that it took reasonable efforts to protect its trade secrets. And if they can't establish this, the information at issue probably won't be classified as a trade secret. As the name suggests, trade secrets, they're secrets. They need to be kept secret, and companies have to demonstrate affirmatively the steps, the sort of concrete steps they have taken to that the information at issue is kept secret. and I reference here, it's a case several decades old at this point, but it's cited quite often. The Fisher Stoves case involved the plaintiff was claiming that its dealer lists were confidential or were trade secret information. And ultimately, though, through discovery, the defendant established that these dealer lists were actually just available for the asking. Anybody could really put them together, get them easily, and as a result, the court wasn't willing to consider them to be quote-unquote trade secrets and available for trade secret protection. So, again, it's critical that the employer, which typically the employer, demonstrates that they kept the trade secret information secret. So who's taking this data? Who's stealing these trade secrets? This slide sums up, research has indicated that over 90% of trade secret misappropriation comes from rogue employees and business partners. And as no surprise, the vast majority is through electronic means. Obviously, these are the folks that have access and familiarity to the trade secret information. And it's usually in this day and age in electronic format. Companies can take a lot of steps to protect trade secrets from the outside world, firewalls, passwords, and the like, but that doesn't mean that that information is safe from those sort of behind the gates and behind the walls. And those are employees and business folks. And it's those folks who have that access who are most likely the ones who haven't hacked in, but who typically take the trade secrets oftentimes just before they leave or in anticipation of leaving for new employment. And obviously technology makes it easy for for them to secure and take this type of electronic information. Obviously we've got all kinds of remote access, cloud computing, the days of someone having to walk into an office and make photocopies to take the company secrets are long gone. So with that, I do want to, without any further ado, I want to dive into several cases addressing social media and trade secrets. I will say probably the moment you've all been waiting for, I'm going to go ahead and read the CLE attendance affirmation code, which is probably the most valuable piece of information you'll get all day. That code is SS, the letters S as in Sifar Shaw, SS0603, so SS0603, and that's the code that you need to write down when you get the email form sent to you. That'll be the code that they're looking for. So without any further ado, the first case I want to talk about is a case involving LinkedIn. This is from the Eastern District of New York. It's a 2010 case, so it's several years old at this point, but still relevant. Essentially, this was a former employee of an executive search consulting firm who the former employer accused her of taking a customer list of theirs and soliciting those clients, and the former employee sued their former employer. Ultimately, the former employee demonstrated how she claimed she did not take the list, but in fact was able to recreate it essentially using social media and other forms of media, such as Google, LinkedIn, Bloomberg, and essentially show that anybody, she and anyone else, could compile the information. And as the plaintiff's customer list could be put together via the internet and social media sites. And sure enough, the court held that the client database did not constitute a trade secret because the same information was easily accessible online to the public. Now, an important note here as well, another factor that very much helped the former employee was the court also found that the database at issue was outdated and not safeguarded. So it was really a sort of triple whammy for the former employer, and that persuaded the court to also find that the information could not constitute a trade secret. So a good example of when a company does not safeguard information, but then in addition, when the former employee could demonstrate that it could be put together by using outside sources such as LinkedIn, it was really a total loser for the former employer. Another case is Phone Dog versus Kravitz. This is a Northern District of California case from 2011 involving Twitter. And essentially, in this case, you had a former employee whose job was to manage the company's Twitter account. And when he left, he took the account, he changed the account handle, and the former employer sued. And they asserted, among other things, misappropriation of trade secrets. They claimed that the Twitter password and the Twitter account followers constituted trade secrets. Now, the former employee tried to bring this to a head quickly, filed a motion to dismiss, claiming the password belonged to him, and the Twitter account followers weren't secret because they were publicly available for all to see. The court actually denied the motion to dismiss. It stated that at a motion to dismiss stage that the former employer had stated a viable claim that the Twitter followers were trade secret information. And that result may have been different at a motion for summary judgment stage or certainly down the road, but at the motion to dismiss stage, the court let the claim survive and also didn't dismiss the claim that the employer's claim that the password belonged to it as well. We understand that the parties ultimately settled this case, but we also understand that the employee was allowed to keep the account in question. Next case is a District of Colorado case from March 2012. It involves MySpace, which some of you may remember. I know I do. Similar to the Twitter case, this issue here was whether a company's friend list could constitute a trade secret or not. And the court found that that list could constitute a trade secret. It was ultimately what they said, it was a question of fact, but given the 8-part test used by the 10th Circuit, they said that the MySpace friends list could classify as a trade secret and therefore would not grant a motion to dismiss. And again, this was important to note at a motion to dismiss stage, so the standard was pretty high. And we note here, though, but ultimately the jury found against the trade secrets claim. So the former employee sort of won the battle, but ultimately didn't win the war. Or against the former employer, rather. So, at this point, can we definitively say whether customer lists and social media constitute trade secrets? The short answer is no. We can't. It's still an open issue. It's a highly intense factual issue, as we discussed in each of these cases. It really depends on a lot of factors, and such as ease of access to the information at issue via outside sources, among other things. Sort of going hand in hand with that is, and Josh alluded to this earlier, is the issue of ownership. Who owns the information typically found on social media platforms? And unfortunately, this is unsettled too. In the Phone Dog case, there was no agreement regarding the ownership of the Twitter account that the employee created. There's a case, Eagle versus Morgan, which is from the Eastern District of Pennsylvania in 2013. And for those of you, for any of these sites, feel free to shoot me an email and I'll give you the exact sites. And unfortunately, since I'm running tight on time, I can't go into a whole lot of detail on these. But essentially in Eagle versus Morgan, there was no agreement at issue between a former employee and the former employer. The former employee was the former CEO, and when she left her company, the company took over her LinkedIn account and replaced it with the name of the new CEO and essentially locked her out of her LinkedIn account. And the company tried to argue that they owned the LinkedIn account, and the court disagreed with that. But ultimately, the former employee was not able to establish sort of any damages, so it was sort of a no harm, no foul once she demonstrated that there were no damages. But the company did not have an explicit agreement that it owned the LinkedIn account, and as a result, the LinkedIn account did belong to the former employee. Another interesting case is the Artist Health versus Nan Kivel case, Southern District of New York in 2011. That was a case that shows the importance of having an account, an agreement rather, between a former an employee and an employer. And it was someone who was hired, again, former employee leaves. They took passwords and other information, and the company really was able to slam it down pretty quickly because it was uncontested by virtue of an agreement that they had that the plaintiffs had the right to the access information, and that access information belonged to the company. Last but not least, I want to touch on briefly restrictive covenants and social media. We see the interplay, just like trade secrets with social media, we see restrictive covenants popping up in social media a lot. The two cases I want to highlight here are listed, and the first one is a 2011 case. The prepaid legal services is a 2013 case. Enhanced Networks is an interesting case. It's when two companies, Enhanced Network and Hypersonic, entered into agreement where they agreed not to solicit each other's employees. And Hypersonic subsequently posted a job opening on its LinkedIn page. And Enhanced had a employee who applied for the job and ultimately was hired by Hypersonic. And Enhanced filed suit claiming that Hypersonic breached the party's agreement by allowing one of their employees to apply and then be hired. The court disagreed. The court found that simply posting a public LinkedIn job post did not violate the restrictive covenant, the non-solicit that the parties had entered into. And in fact, the active step taken was that of the employee who reached out and applied for the job. There was no active step taken by Hypersonic, and posting on a LinkedIn job opening was not sufficiently an affirmative step. Last case is interesting as well. It involved a former employee who had a non-solicit as well with his former employer, prepaid legal services. And when he quit, he had posted some general comments on his Facebook page and Twitter account about his new job. And the former employee tried to say that those posts were essentially were soliciting the former employees or the former colleagues he had at Prepaid Legal to come join him at the new company. The court ultimately held that those did not violate the non-solicit clause. Those types of posts were passive enough that they weren't considered to be active solicitation. So again, highly factually intensive, though it does appear, particularly from these recent cases, that some in the context of restrictive covenants, that posting to sites such as Twitter or LinkedIn or Facebook may not be enough for a former employee to say that an individual has violated their non-solicit. But again, highly factual intensive and something we're certainly keeping an eye on closer. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to John to bring us home.
Great. So Eric's been talking about all of the different things that go on with regard to figuring out whether or not something's a trade secret and then taking the steps to protect that trade secret. And so one of the things that I think is going to be really interesting is a lot of folks who work on trying to figure out how to protect trade secrets are kind of caught in this tension between, well, what instrumentality do we use to make sure that we can protect our trade secrets so we can actually have something defined as secret? One of the comments that's come up, or one of the points that's come up in the cases is, well, do you have an agreement? Well, a lot of places, especially like here in Texas where we are an at-will state, you don't necessarily want to have an agreement. So what do you do? What kind of things do you do to actually create controls that are those measures taken by the company to protect secrecy that we talked about on an earlier slide? So one of the things that you see folks doing is you see folks saying, well, okay, let's create a social media policy. Let's create a BYOD policy. Let's create something that tells the employee what they can and can't do with social media or these blended devices, these personal devices that you actually do work on. That sounds great. That sounds fine. A lot of folks do that. Weird stuff starts sticking its head up and creating havoc with creating these policies, not the least of which is the National Labor Relations Board. So most folks would go, wait a minute, why the heck does the NLRB care about this? What's going on here? This is, you know, consumer privacy or worker privacy, or why the heck is the NLRB talking about this? Well, the NLRB is, like most folks, concerned about how information is being used within their constituency, within the folks that they're designed to protect. And the NLRA is designed to protect folks when they're engaged in protected concerted activities. Now you go, wait a minute, what's going on here? I'm talking about protecting my trade secrets. Well, in 2010, the NLRB started issuing a series of reports looking at how these social media policies are written. And the unfortunate thing is the level of ambiguity was viewed negatively by the NLRB. They're looking at the concept that a worker may perceive the social media policy as prohibiting concerted activity. And as a consequence, they started talking about, well, wait a minute, you can't have a policy that says you're not allowed to talk about wages or hours or terms and conditions. Even though some folks will turn around and say, look, what I pay people is considered a trade secret because I either don't want people to know that I'm paying 20% below market, or I don't want people to know that I'm paying 20% above market. The problem with that is the NLRB says can't do that. So what they've done is they've issued a series of reports talking about what their view has been with regard to how these social media policies have been structured. Now, the 20 policies that they've reviewed, they were looking about, they looked at 16 of them as significantly overly broad. And about half of these were talking about, well, the reason why they're overly broad is you're basically saying you can't use Facebook for anything that's not approved by the company. You know, whether it's a personal Facebook account or not, you know, this is could easily be perceived by the employee as saying, by policy, we're not allowed to talk about, you know, working conditions. The most recent report in 2012 really stressed the idea that overbroad language, which is what a lot of us lawyers like to write, is not going to work for you. And the other thing that's really interesting about the 2012 report is the other technique that a lot of us lawyers use in writing policies, which is effectively savings clauses, that doesn't work. So the NLRB has said, yeah, you may have a savings clause in there, but that's not necessarily going to work for you. On top of these reports, the Office of the General Counsel in March 18th of this year also issued a memorandum with regard to employer rules and the cases associated with that. There is some guidance, but the interesting thing is the guidance tends to be also incredibly fact-specific, and depending on what time of the day you read some of this guidance, it may actually conflict with itself. So you're looking at general language that everybody would normally see as being perfectly reasonable in these policies. The NLRB is going, yeah, this doesn't work for us. Like, you can't have objectionable or inflammatory comments. Well, a lot of us in the labor and employment space would go, wait a minute, we have to have language like that because otherwise we're potentially subjecting ourselves to liability around hostile work environment or harassment. Well, objectionable or inflammatory comments need to be specified because the way the NLRB looks at it is those types of comments may be inflammatory to the company because you're saying the company has bad working conditions. That's different than saying, you know, my next door neighbor is a horrible person and I'm going to do something nasty to him. So you end up having this need to be fairly specific in the language that you draft when you're talking about these types of social media policies being developed. The other thing that's challenging is when is the social media account under the purview of the social media policy? because it's clear that a corporation doesn't have the right to regulate private activity outside the scope of the individual employee's employment. So the problem then becomes, well, when are you at work and when are you not? If I, for example, if I represent to somebody that I'm an employee of Seyfarth Shaw and I'm on my Facebook page or I'm on my LinkedIn page and I post something that has legal content to it, am I doing it as an independent person or am I doing it as an attorney with Seyfarth Shaw or am I doing it as an attorney associated with a particular case? It's very challenging when there's this blend of it's my page, but I'm using it for professional purposes, and I'm doing it on a company-issued computer, or one worse, I'm doing it on a company-approved computer that I own. So we're seeing this trend around difficulty in terms of evaluating whether or not a particular activity is going to be considered employment activity or considered personal activity. The Ellen case is interesting in this space. The idea around having the employee be able to control, as opposed to the employer be able to control who could see what. This is something that you need to take into consideration. Again, this is very fact specific because you're looking at this blend between, well, some posts are private and some posts aren't. So the other thing to realize is when you're looking at crafting these policies, you end up in the situation of you may have the same account, but activity on that account may be subject to the policy in one space and may not be subject to the policy in the other space. This also is clear in the Miramont case. So on top of all of this, now what do we do with regard to the state laws? So there are privacy statutes in some states. We talked about the ones that had the social media-specific privacy statutes, but there are also states that have generalized privacy obligations, not the least of which is California. So both the state of California's right to privacy under their constitution as well as their Online Privacy Protection Act actually apply to individuals. They don't distinguish between employees and non-employees. So the question then becomes what kind of privacy or data protection law exists with a particular state on top of the NLRB, on top of what policies you're dealing with. And so you have to be able to craft your policies in such a way where they also comply with the state. And in some instances, the multiplicity of states that you have employees in. Choice of law also becomes interesting. It's really hard to tell a state regulator, that they can't protect their employees when those employees are resident in those states. And so while it's also very handy to have the choice of law provisions, the question is whether or not the provision is reasonable, whether or not it's unconscionable. These are the types of things you have to take into consideration again when you're writing these types of policies. So when you're crafting the policy, you look at, okay, what does the NLRB say? Because they currently are active in investigating and enforcing. And then you have to balance what the NLRB says vis-a-vis the other obligations you have as an employer with regard to protecting employees from harassment and from hostile work environment and those types of things, which actually arise under both state and federal law. So what ends up happening is the level of specificity in these social media policies and also in acceptable use policies as well as bring your own device policies increases. So unlike what we've seen in the past where you can do these broad brush concepts around, okay, this policy can say, don't do anything that makes people uncomfortable. You need to have more specific language, especially considering the comment that was made by the NLRB around the savings clauses not working. So you do that. Job-specific accounts are also one way to consider this. For example, if the company has a Facebook page, and the company, and it's branded the company's Facebook page, it's a company's name as opposed to the person's name. These are the types of things that will go towards having measures taken by a company to protect the capacity to control that page and the content on that page. Still, it's one of these things that needs to be clear to the employee that if they're administering that page, they're not the one who owns that page. Ownership is a really, really touchy subject, and in a lot of ways, it's really hard to use the traditional concept of ownership in this space because, one, it's so in flux, and two, it's really hard for either side of the conversation to be able to assert exclusivity, which is one of the elements of the bundle of rights and ownership. So I think activity-based or functional-based controls really end up being where a lot of these policies end up needing to go. That also allows for you to have some clarity with regard to what the level of personal versus non-personal activity would be. It's also a level of specificity which helps you stay out from underneath the concern of the NLRB, which is the overbroad language. And I know I'm going to be running a little bit short on time on these, so I want to leave some time at the end for some Q&A, but I'll hit some high-level points in terms of things to consider creating a social media policy. Be specific with regard to what's a work-oriented or a non-personal account. Define it. And carve out, hey, if you're doing this on your own time, while you may have to represent to somebody that you are an employer, an employee, you also have to represent that this is not based on your activity as an employee. So being able to clearly articulate what's personal, what's not personal. Articulate specifically what kind of investigations will trigger a requirement to review arguably personal activity. For example, if somebody is needing to investigate harassment, you need to be able to have a clear policy that says, we will investigate your personal account if we're doing so on the basis of a legal requirement. If you get a subpoena, for example, you know, if you get a warrant. Now, it's going to be odd in the event that a warrant or a subpoena would be served on a business. It generally is served on the individual, but stranger things have happened. Litigation discovery, litigation holds. These are also things that are going to be important to consider when you're drafting a social media policy, an acceptable use policy, or a bring your own device policy. And then clearly, conflicts of laws around, okay, how does the NLRB interface with the Historic Communications Act, interface with the right to privacy, interface with the obligation of the employer to have a safe and harassment-free workspace. These are all things that need to be considered when you're writing these policies. And as a consequence, it requires a level of expertise and a level of talent in terms of writing these policies that a lot of us haven't thought about needing to apply to these kinds of policies in the past. So one of the more interesting cases that have come out of this recently is the Arias case. This has just been filed, and this is a good example of how the implications can be very real and very immediate in the event that you don't have a good policy or that the policy is overbroad. So the case in this one, which hasn't had a hearing yet, but it was the complaint is very interesting. The employer was requiring an employee with an employer-issued phone to always have the phone on them, and there was going to be GPS tracking on that. So the employee is sitting here thinking to themselves, wait a minute, I may be on call, but everything I do is not part of my employment. I don't like this. I don't want the employer to track me. So she complains, deletes the app on the phone, even though the phone is not hers, and subsequently gets terminated. It's going to be interesting to see how the court views whether or not that was an overreach by the company. But that kind of litigation is also going to have an impact on how we end up crafting these types of policies. Clearly, this is something that is of concern of a lot of folks. DC is talking about it. Josh commented that there are some very recent state laws that have been passed with regard to social media. This is an issue that's not going to go away. This is an issue that's going to continue to be challenging. This is an issue that's going to continue to be in need of some serious, thoughtful approaches. And it's going to be one of these things where you have to consider the ramifications because unlike what it used to be, which is, oh, I'm a consumer and I'm suing, you know, a particular company over a breach. It's now also the NLRB getting into this space around, hey, you've got to protect your employees' data as well. So the employment status in many instances is becoming just as critical with regard to creating an obligation around data protection as a consumer status was under something along the lines of HIPAA or Gramm-Leach-Bliley. So these are the things that we've got to take into consideration while we're thinking about how we protect our secrets as well as how we protect our employees' data as well as how we create the interface between how the employee works with their data versus our data and the equipment that they use and the technology that they use and the platforms that they use with regard to being an employee and being able to interface with other employers or other employees or other prospects. And with that, thank you much, and I will offer that we have some great blogs to look at, and once that's, you guys have a chance to review those, I'd like to take some questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will conduct the question and answer session. To ask a question via the web presentation, select the chat pod located in the lower left-hand corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. We are now ready to begin. Our first question comes from Joshua Bright. It says, putting aside the issue of privacy laws, is personally identifiable information subject to trade secret protection? In particular, I am interested in the issue of economic value of the information where hackers could use the information for economic gain, such as social security number, date of birth information, and ability to open accounts with the information.
So this is John, and I'll take a first crack at that. I would be cautious to look at it from a trade secret perspective because you actually have multiple folks that have rights in the data. That doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't value associated with the data, and it doesn't necessarily mean that there's not a way that both the company and the individual who is impacted by a data breach, for example, can proceed against a bad actor. But it would be challenging in saying, oh, my credit card number is trade secret data because you use it every single time you do a transaction, so it's not secret. Social security number, probably a little bit closer, but even there, those are on public records, for example, if you have a mortgage. So personally identifiable information is going to be a little more challenging under trade secret law, but it definitely doesn't mean that there aren't mechanisms by which you can approach protecting it and actually having a remedy in the event somebody hijacks it.
I can take a next question we have is concerns whether a BYOD policy could be considered a type of shoulder surfing that some of the recent social media legislation has tried to prohibit. On the one hand, it's kind of unclear because there is no case law. It seems the intent really for shoulder surfing was where the employer kind of requires or demands that the employee log in and provide access to the account. With BYOD policies, it does become an interesting situation because, you know, that data could just be, you know, not necessarily physically seen over the shoulder, but kind of in the background, monitored or tracked by whatever software or systems recording it. So the issue which we've seen a lot of in these cases is whether the company actually has provided, you know, sufficient notice that the company or that the employee has no reasonable expectation of privacy in whatever that device or computer account is. So a lot of times companies will have that built into their policy. This not only rises in kind of these type of disputes, but also with kind of discovery disputes where the company tries to get into, you know, these personal accounts or information. So kind of going back, it doesn't seem necessarily that I guess whether the BYOD policy could be shoulder surfing, it may not be unless the company requires the employee to actually install maybe a certain app that they wouldn't have access to. But I think ultimately the issue is going to be how that expectation of privacy is communicated to the employee through the company's policies.
Yeah, the shoulder surfing is less of a concern from a privacy perspective than federal and state wiretap type statutes like ECPA and the Stored Communications Act. That's really where the concern is going to arise and generate the same level of obligation on the company to have an appropriate policy that says, look, we will do this and we will do this as our general course of business.
There was a question that was posed about sort of the interplay between personal LinkedIn accounts and company LinkedIn accounts, and that was in some of the couple cases I discussed. And specifically, there was a question asked about an individual who has their own personal LinkedIn account, but then has to essentially maintain the company's LinkedIn, part of a company's LinkedIn page through their account. So you get this mixing, this blending of personal LinkedIn information with then the company's quote-unquote information, or potentially what the company would say is their information. And then what would happen if an individual like that left the company? Whose information, you know, what information would she or he or she be allowed to take or have to give back? And again, in the context of it being completely intermixed with her personal or his or her personal account. And the short answer there is it's difficult to say. You'd go back to the factors. You would look to see what if there had been an agreement in place about ownership of that information. But the line gets blurry. The line gets particularly blurry in the context of people that are in sales, because leads and potential clients are key. So if that person, for instance, is selling product but then adds contacts to their personal LinkedIn pages and they leave the company might say and have in writing that LinkedIn or that their customer lists are theirs, so they can't take it. But the former employee might say, well, that's all fine and good and you can take all that back, but I've also got this personal LinkedIn page and I've got all those names on there too. So there's not a bright line answer. Josh and John, I welcome your thoughts on it as well, but it's why this area is just sort of in real need of sort of teeming with litigation, certainly litigation potential.
Yeah, the only thing I would end on would be this concept of you need to think about the consequences or the unintended consequences of blending what has historically been personal activity with work-related activity. Not to say that you can't do it. It requires some serious thought, and it's not something that you can do just by saying, "Oh yeah, sure. Well, we'll just let everybody use their own computer for everything that they do for work."
Right.
There's a lot more that needs to go into thinking about these types of controls than a lot of people have really put thought into.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.